Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to get started, and we're going to be talking in this session about how to optimize Hyper-V to make it more highly available, specifically focusing on how we actually get it to run on top of a failover cluster. I'm Simon Perryman, a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft headquarters, and I spent about 4 years on the failover clustering team, actually designing a lot of these features specifically for Hyper-V. Now, last 2.5 years, I've been at Microsoft, I've been an evangelist, so I've had a lot of opportunities to talk to you, get your feedback, and I do continue to share that back with our engineering team. So since we have somewhat of a small audience, at least while we kind of stay on track with time, I will open it up to questions. So if you want to ask a question about the relevant topic that we're talking about, we'll try to have a discussion around that. If we do start to run short of time, though, I will ask that we'll hold off questions until the end. Sound good? All right, well, let's get started. What we're going to be discussing is kind of four key areas around Hyper-V cluster design. First, we're looking at the different planning considerations, the different layers of high availability that we can build throughout our system. Secondly, we're going to look at how we can go and optimize that using best practices that are actually available today in Windows Server 2008 R2 and in Windows Server, actually just in Windows Server 2008 R2, not even 2012 yet. So we still have a lot of customers that haven't upgraded. So I want to kind of highlight some of these best practices that are still available in the previous releases. Next, we're going to focus all on the new stuff, 2012, 2012 R2, how we've made our solutions even more highly available, even more resilient. And then finally, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about System Center 2012 R2 and how we can go use Virtual Machine Manager, Operations Manager, Orchestrator to go make even more higher availability throughout our infrastructure. So let's talk about failover cluster planning. What are the key considerations you need to keep your virtual machines up and running? Well, we really look at 6 different layers of availability. First thing we want to focus on is our hardware high availability. This is really, you know, providing the resiliency within the actual physical infrastructure. Next, we look at availability for the workloads running on the hosts, such as VMs, maybe a SQL server that's on top of a cluster. This is kind of your more traditional clustering. Next, we're going to go up a level and talk about guest clustering. Guest clustering is when we have 2 or more virtual machines that are running Windows Server, and those VMs actually form a cluster within the virtualized layer. Next, we're going to talk about high availability for our actual storage of the virtual machines themselves using a scale-out file server. So we can lose access to our storage, the VMs stay running, redirect their access throughout a different point over an SMB share. We're then going to look at management availability using System Center. So not only do we want to make sure that we can manage our clusters well, but also think about availability for those management systems too. How do I keep VMM highly available? How do I keep Ops Manager online so those stay resilient? Those keep my infrastructure running. And last but not least, we're going to cover site availability as well, looking at multi-site clustering, Hyper-V replication, how we can really fail over from losing an entire data center, cross data centers, keeping our infrastructure online. So a lot of content that we're going to cover here. So first of all, hardware high availability. I'm not going to go through this in detail. These are just best practices that you want to follow and have been well documented for many years. You really first want to think about having redundant server roles throughout your infrastructure. So redundancy in the server. Always have 2 domain controllers, 2 DNS servers, 2 DHCP servers. Separate them. If they're virtualized, make sure they're running on different hosts. The system itself, you want to have protection for power. You want to have sensors in your baseboard management controller, BMC. So if there's a problem with a chip, a problem with a fan, something's overheating, it could go send an alert to you before that physical hardware has a problem. Most of the processes we see now have built-in error detection as well. So looking for instruction problems. If an instruction fails, they will automatically retry it. Extended precision bits so that you can get more information within a block of data. Within memory, we have memory protection errors. If we notice that a bit of memory is getting faulty, we can actually isolate that, not add any data to it, so that next reboot, free it up. Parity bits, journaling, scrubbing. So again, lots of stuff built right in here. Now within our storage, we want to have redundancy through our storage fabric as well. Multiple paths using MPIO. We want to have rated disks, so if we lose a disk, we can still have access to the data. We can still recover it. And then some of the more traditional disk resiliency mechanisms, like journaling, which keeps writing additional bits ahead of time, parity bits, so if you lose information, you can recover it. And then resilient file system is another option, which you can go add to your storage. Now, resilient file system was a new type of file system designed by Microsoft, released with Windows Server 2000, known as REFS. So if you go and format a disk, you get the traditional options of like FAT, NTFS. You now see REFS as well. So what REFS is basically the file system has built-in logic to make it resilient. So the file system itself is doing background scrubbing, error checking, it has parity bits. So the file system itself is resilient along with the actual disks as well. So you kind of get that resilience throughout the stack. Then finally, networking. Best practices of course, having redundant networks, having NIC teaming, using a load balancer to distribute the traffic, multi-channel SMB. So a lot of best practices you could build in the hardware. But this is not a course or not a presentation on hardware availability. We want to really focus on virtualization here. And so we're going to do that by looking at our workload availability here. Host clustering, what you're most used to. So with this, we're going to be able to protect against an application crashing on the host. We can restart it. We can fail it over to different hosts. If an application no longer has access to storage or networking, we can go send it to another host that does have access. Now, within the virtual machines themselves, if you have a virtual machine running on a host, we can actually detect whether that VM operating system has frozen, if there's a blue screen, a user mode hang, and even restart that virtual machine. We can have zero downtime maintenance by doing live migration. We have our two physical hosts. We live migrate the VMs between them, patch the other one. This means our applications and VMs can have no downtime while our host infrastructure is patched. Now with guest clustering, again, we got our VMs. We install Windows Server, connect them. This is where we actually run our applications. And this is a best practice that we want all of our customers to use if they're highly virtualized. Have resiliency on the physical level with host clustering, and then resiliency in the application layer within the VMs using guest clustering. So what are the benefits of guest clustering? Well, what happens when you need to patch a VM? It's going to need a reboot, right? So we could go fail over our applications between our two virtual nodes, patch it, reboot. Now, when we do a failover, there will be downtime. But that amount of downtime is often seconds, compared to the amount of downtime if it's a standalone virtual machine, you take everything offline, reboot it, let it start up, bring it back online. So while that type of patching is not zero downtime, it significantly reduces the amount of downtime you have. But then additionally, with guest clustering, you get application availability as well. If you run a SQL server inside the VM, we detect if that SQL server crashes. We restart the SQL server. We fail over that SQL server between the different guest nodes. So it's kind of the same concept, same best practices as your traditional host clustering, but you're just adding it another layer, adding it to the virtual layer. Now, VM storage availability was introduced in Windows Server 2012 through what we call a scale-out file server. Now, the way a scale-out file server works is it's built on top of a cluster, but it provides multiple access points to our actual file server. So if you think of what a traditional file cluster does, it has a disk, it has an access point, WAC, SOFS, a client goes and connects to that node, they access the disk. If that node fails, that access point goes offline, the disk and the access point will fail over to a different physical host. Client access point comes back online. Disk is online. Client reconnects. But there's downtime when that happens. So what we did with the scale-out file system is we actually go and put these file share names, WAC, SOFS, across multiple different hosts in the cluster. Now, there's two advantages of this. First of all, it helps us do traffic balancing. When a client goes and connects to a routing table and says, I want to go connect to this file server, they will get different IP addresses, and they will get spread out across these different access points. So you're not pushing everything through a single server, through a single storage path. Secondly, if that file server actually crashes, we will immediately redirect a client to another one. So if they're even doing a file copy, they lose access to one of the servers, the file copy will hang, but then it will resume as soon as that client gets reconnected to a different server. So this gives us built-in resiliency through our files. So how is this relevant to Hyper-V? Well, with Windows Server 2012, we started supporting Hyper-V over SMB, which means that you can use a file share to store your Hyper-V virtual machines. It also means you can use a scale-out file server to store your virtual machines. So when you go and configure the file server, instead of using traditional cluster storage, like Fiber Channel or Serial Attached SCSI or iSCSI, you can now have an additional option of using file shares. And if you think about what a file share is, it's basically remote storage. If you have two servers that have access to the same file share, that's shared storage in a sense. They're both simultaneously being able to access that file share. So what you can do when you go and configure your Hyper-V virtual machines, instead of putting them on your traditional storage, you could put them on WACWAC, SOFS, Scale Out File Server. This way, the virtual machine will keep running. It will send traffic across different paths to distribute the load. If a path or a server becomes unavailable, it will just simply reroute the traffic through another path. And so this means you can patch your backend cluster one node at a time, you can have failures, and you can still keep your virtual machines online and running. So now we've got several different layers of resiliency. We've got our hardware, got our traditional clusters, our guest clusters, and then high availability for access to the storage as well. But now we've got to think about management availability. How do we keep our management systems online and running as well? And with management, I'm talking about System Center 2012. So first of all, some best practices for the actual management server itself. Have multiple instances. Don't just have a single VMM server, have multiple VMM servers. You can also run them inside virtual machines. So you get those benefits of being able to live migrate the VMM server or live migrate your DPM server that's doing backup. You can back up all of those different System Center components using Data Protection Manager. And you can monitor them with Operations Manager. So if a server crashes, we can send an alert. We can do whatever we need to go bring it back up. Now, System Center also runs on SQL databases as their backend storage, where they keep track of configuration items, measurements, users, things like that. This supports all the traditional types of SQL clustering. So you can get SQL high availability as well. You could do SQL replication. You could back up your SQL database, monitor it with a management pack, run SQL inside a clustered VM. So all of these kind of traditional best practices we talked about for our applications, we can also do with our management system as well. But now there are actually unique features for each of the different System Center components as well to provide higher availability. First of all, System Center Advisor. That's the new component that I demoed in the keynote this morning. It's a cloud-based best practice analyzer. That's going to go and analyze your Windows Server hosts, your Hyper-V hosts, your failover cluster nodes, and look at best practices that you may or may not be following to give you recommendations to build resiliency in there. Many of the different System Center components have web consoles, App Controller, Orchestrator, Service Manager, several others, one of the deployment managers. They basically have websites that people can go and access. Well, those websites can be made highly available as well using load balancing. They're simply layer 2 HTTP requests, websites, so we could go distribute traffic on those so those websites always stay online. Operations Manager has redundant management servers that you can put in a highly available management group. Orchestrator has a similar concept with their runbook servers, where you can have primary servers and then secondary servers that will go and be promoted if a primary is down. So you can make sure you're always monitoring and always automating your environment. And VMM itself has high availability for its library, so you can always access your VHDs, ISO files. And with 2012, you can now directly run Virtual Machine Manager on a failover cluster. Not within a VM, but directly on top of the failover cluster. So it can quickly restart, it could fail over between the nodes. So we have high availability built throughout our management system as well. But what about site high availability? What if you lose an entire data center? Well, we call this multi-site clustering, where we have multiple locations. We stretch our cluster across the different sites. This gives us the ability to survive the loss of an entire data center. You can have multi-site clusters stretched across 5 data centers, 64 data centers even, one node at each data center. Now, some important things to keep in mind is you want to have replication going between these sites. Let's say you have 2 sites. You need to have storage at both of those locations, because if one site becomes unavailable, we still want to make sure that we have our application data, our VHD files, whatever we need, at our second site. So as part of this, you want to make sure that you have replication as a consideration. Now, there's a few different technologies we can use to achieve this. We've had multi-site failover clustering around since Windows Server 2003. That's a single cluster with nodes on multiple sites. You fail over between the different sites. We now added Hyper-V replica with Windows Server 2012. We're going to talk a little more about that later, but that allows us to actually replicate VMs from our first site to our second site asynchronously as a nice disaster recovery solution. And then we just introduced the Windows Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager with this release, which is an Azure-based service that will allow you to coordinate failover from one site to a second site. And we'll spend a little more time talking about that one later as well. But key message here is, think throughout the stack about this availability. Don't just think about traditional clustering. Think of the hardware, the software, the virtual machines, the storage, the management system, and of course, the entire site. Now, next question I always get asked is, can I go and mix my physical and virtual nodes? How do I go and do this? Can I have these clusters, one built on top of the other? Absolutely, we support all these different scenarios. You could have this physical clustering, this guest clustering, this SMB storage clustering layered on top of each other. Now, it does add some complexity, right? You've got to manage more clusters at the same time. You've got to think about what storage each of these different layers are accessing. But this is going to provide you with the best end-to-end resiliency. You can't even mix physical nodes and virtual nodes. We don't have any limitations around that, so long as they pass the cluster validation tests. Now, in reality, do a lot of people mix them? Not really. You know, there's definitely benefits of having the high availability of the hardware layer or at the virtual layer. But we often see customers do this in kind of test environments, proof of concepts, where they have limited physical hardware. Get a single physical box, get dozens of VMs that represent other nodes, and you could kind of use that to go plan these deployments, test them out, use proof of concepts. Now, I also want to recommend one of the other operating systems to give you even higher availability, which is Microsoft Hyper-V Server. Now, Microsoft Hyper-V Server is kind of a trimmed-down version of Windows Server, but it's going to give you higher availability. Now, it's trimmed down because it only includes Hyper-V features. It includes networking, storage, and clustering. But it doesn't include those other server components like file server, Active Directory, DNS, any of that. It's basically a Hyper-V host. Now, the big advantage here is it supports every single Hyper-V feature, every single cluster feature, all of these scales as well. So you can have 64-node Hyper-V server clusters, 8,000 virtual machines, have these multiple layers, these multiple tiers, fully supported. And best of all, it is completely free. You could go download this. There is no license. It does not expire. It is not an evaluation edition. We offer this as a completely free hypervisor. So a lot of people say, why would Microsoft go and do this? Why would you give away a free hypervisor? You guys like to make money, right? Well, we want to do this to just help increase adoption of Hyper-V. It's as simple as that. It's a strategic play to get people to try it out, to get people to adopt it while reducing their actual acquisition costs. Again, it supports all these same features. But how is it highly available? How is this a recommendation that we want people to use it? Well, if you think about one of the biggest sources of downtime, it comes from patching, right? Think about a patch. While it goes through a patch cycle, it's downtime, it's live migrating, it's rebooting the operating system. Well, the good thing about Hyper-V Server, there's no graphical user interface. There's none of these other additional components. There's no Internet Explorer. This means there's fewer security vulnerabilities, which means there's fewer patches, which means there's fewer reboots, which means you get even more uptime. Now, as far as the licensing goes, you know, next question I always get asked is, could I have a completely free solution throughout the stack? Could I, in theory, have Hyper-V server on my host, have Linux virtual machines? Yeah, we have no limitations around that. You can have an almost free virtualization solution. Here's kind of the one catch, though, when you still need Windows Server. Failover clustering has a requirement of Active Directory. So if you actually want to build a cluster using Hyper-V Server, you still need to have domain controllers based on Active Directory. So you still, somewhere in your infrastructure, need to have your full Windows Server licenses, but all of your Hyper-V hosts can be running for free. The complaint that a lot of people say, though, is this has no graphical user interface. It's going to be kind of hard to manage. I like, you know, to be able to click around. I hate using PowerShell, but you shouldn't. PowerShell's great. So what's really nice about this, though, it supports all of our remoting tools. So you can use full version of Hyper-V Manager with the graphical user interface, connect to this. Same with Failover Cluster Manager. Same with Virtual Machine Manager. Same with remote server administration tools. So you can get these full graphical user interface, connect remotely to these core boxes, and have higher availability, better resiliency. So we definitely want to encourage everybody to think about this as they roll out their next deployments. So as you go and actually choose a host operating system here, there's a couple different licensing considerations. You know, we kind of talked about Hyper-V Server already. The host operating system is free. You don't have to worry about the guests. Well, you don't get any licenses for the guests. Now, this differs from the two traditional licenses that come with Windows Server, Standard Edition and Data Center Edition. So when should you go and use each? Well, the main difference between these two is virtualization rights. When you buy Standard Edition, you get the one license for the physical server. You get two licenses for two VMs. So not that great if you're highly virtualized. With Data Center Edition, all you need is one license, and you get unlimited rights to any VMs. Now, the difference here, though, is that Standard Edition is licensed per proc. Sorry, both of these are licensed per proc. The main difference here, though, again, is virtualization rights. So if you're highly virtualized, go with Data Center Edition. Now, one key message here, and this is brand new for Windows Server 2012 R2, Hyper-V clusters are different. In the past, we have always said, run all your clusters kind of the same way. Well, we've really rethought that with this release because we realize there's different hardware requirements, different network requirements, different storage requirements for our Hyper-V clusters. So you're actually going to find we have now built changes into failover clustering where your clusters will behave differently if they have Hyper-V on them versus if they have any other role. So the first of these differences is new validation tests. So we now have tests in our cluster validation wizard specific for Hyper-V, and we're going to review those a little later. We now support these shared VHDX disks. We're going to cover this later as well, but this basically allows our guest clusters to go and use a file for its shared storage instead of having to use a traditional LAN or traditional shared storage. We have different heartbeat settings. So as soon as you go and add your first virtual machine to the cluster, we will go and automatically change the frequency that we do health checks. So just for some background on what is a heartbeat. A heartbeat is basically what each of the cluster nodes are doing to check that other cluster nodes are alive. It's a simple ping, and it's essentially just saying, are you alive? Do you look alive? Are you alive? If they get a response, we know that this cluster's still active, still part of membership. Now, what we change now is the frequency that we go and ping them. Now, we've realized with so many customers virtualizing, so many customers using Hyper-V, those networks between the cluster nodes are often getting flooded with live migration traffic, cluster shared volume traffic, update traffic. And this gets even worse as we get larger and larger. We now support these 64-node clusters. And so we had a lot of customers complaining and saying, hey, these default settings aren't right for us. our heartbeats are getting dropped. We just have too much network traffic, too much going on. And so we realize this, and we now have automatically adjusted the default setting for the heartbeat so they're happening less frequently, so you're less likely to get a false failover. The fourth major improvement is a completely internal improvement. Probably most people wouldn't even realize this change has happened. And this gets to do with our updating system. Now, internally, the way that a cluster actually works is every single node has its own set of registry keys that we call the cluster database, or clusdb. That's actually stored in the registry under hklm/cluster. Now, the way that updates work in clusters is when a change happens to one node, let's say a resource gets deployed, this node now knows that he has a new resource type virtual machine, something like that. But it's important to make sure that every other node in the cluster is aware that there's been a change that's happened. And the reason why is if a change happens on one node, and then that node gets isolated, the cluster will continue to function and not realize that there's a change that should have been applied globally. So what we do, as soon as a change happens on one node in a cluster, we automatically go and update every other node. So a change could be a new workload gets deployed, a private property is changed, a resource goes from online to offline to saved to pending. Basically, any type of state change that happens in the cluster, we want to make sure that every single node has a view of that. So if a partition happens, every other node knows what the cluster should look like. So the challenge that we saw with these updates is for the update to actually be completed, when one node says, I have a new virtual machine, he goes and blasts this out, sends this update out to the other nodes in the cluster, which could be 63 nodes in the cluster. And it needs to wait for these responses to come back, these acknowledgements to come back. Once it receives these acknowledgements, it says, okay, everybody knows this change. I'm now actually going to go and perform this action. I will now actually deploy this workload. Now, the challenge that we saw again as we started to scale up, get these large clusters that were running VMs, was this performance overhead. It would say, hey, I need to make a change. It would send the information out. The networks would be saturated. And sometimes it would take several minutes for all the requests to come back. And so that slowed deployment time, it slowed online time, it slowed time that you could actually bring your VMs back online. So what we've done in the R2 release is we've updated this internal algorithm. Rather than waiting for every single node to send back, we've received it, we now only require a majority of nodes to send it back. This way, we know that no matter where we have a partition, at any point in time, more than half of the nodes have an updated state, an updated view of the cluster. So this is increasing the time that it takes to online our VMs and do other actions by about 50%. So this is actually an internal performance increase you'll see. And that's done using this mechanism called our Global Update Manager, or GUM. So again, really want to emphasize this point in R2. We've really focused on Hyper-V, optimizing it, making it more performant, because Hyper-V clusters are different. All right, so let's actually talk about some best practices for optimization that are available today. And by today, I mean available in 2008 R2, and in some cases earlier. These still apply to 2012, so definitely best practices you want to be interested in. But if you haven't quite upgraded yet, these are still things that you can benefit from today. So first thing you want to think about is enabling the monitoring of our actual virtual machines, the guest operating system. Now in 2008 R2, believe it or not, this setting was off by default. You actually had to go to the property of the virtual machine, select enable heart beating, and from that point in time, that's when the actual host would check the guest operating system, checking for user mode hangs, making sure it hasn't blue screened. So what we did in 2012, this setting is now on by default in the later version, but it's a best practice to enable it. This way, if a VM freezes or a VM hangs, we can restart it, we can fail it over to another node. So it's kind of getting some insight within the VM itself. The next option that we had was disabling low-priority VMs. Now, VM prioritization was a feature that only came out in 2012, but in our earlier versions, we actually kind of had this feature. It was just exposed a different way. You actually, in our old version, had two options. You could say that a VM would automatically start after a crash, or it would stay offline and not automatically start. And so the goal around here was to make sure that high-priority VMs always came online first, low-priority VMs stayed offline until we were ready to bring them online. And so benefits here are making sure that your critical infrastructure comes up first. Now, as you kind of look internally at what happens when a virtual machine starts up, the running requirements to start a VM are different than the requirements to run it in kind of standard production, usually. If you think about what happens when you start a VM, you're actually booting an operating system. You're connecting to storage, connecting to network, loading drivers, doing logon, running startup scripts. So we often find there's kind of like an initial burst of processing that happens when we boot, and then it kind of tapers down and you kind of have your regular production workload. Now the challenge that we saw when we had lots of VMs on a single host and that host crashed was all the VMs would try to start up at once. And even if that host could run all of them at the regular workload, it couldn't necessarily start them all at the same time when they were peaking. There was too much resource contention. We called this a startup storm. Now, in some cases, this got so bad with some customers that they would try to start up all of their VMs after a crash. It would overload the host, cause that host to crash. Those VMs would fail over to another host, overload that with a startup storm, and it would cause kind of a domino effect and actually take down every node in the cluster. So that's really bad. We want to make sure that doesn't happen. Now, we fix these problems in our later version by having virtual machine prioritization. But if you're still running 2008 and earlier, the way to avoid this is by saying non-important virtual machines do not automatically start. Important virtual machines, you stay online. So this way, you give those important VMs the chance to go through that peak, to level out, and then gradually, you can go and add these additional VMs later. Now, another thing that a lot of people like to do is keeping VMs on preferred hosts. Now, in the past, you know, back in 2003, there was actually a requirement to have every cluster node be identical. That was very painful for our customers because if you wanted to go and update a network card in one of them, you'd have to go update the network card in all of them. It would no longer be supported. So we said, terrible idea. We don't really need everything to be identical. And since then, we've allowed these different types of hosts to run in a cluster. Gradually, we've seen customers upgrade their hardware. They'll start with, you know, maybe an old two-node cluster. A couple years later, buy some better hardware, make it a four-node cluster. Then even better hardware. And just gradually build these larger clusters with additional hardware purchases. Now, what a lot of customers then like to do is actually specify which workloads should run on which of those hosts. If you have some high-end SQL databases, maybe those really should only run on those newest hosts that you have, all these VMs that are running the, you know, SQL. If you have some older workloads, maybe those can run on the older ones. So using our preference options, you can actually specify which VMs should go and run on which hosts. So there's two different options here, preferred owners and possible owners. The way to think about this is preferred owners is a first place choice. If there's a preferred owner available, it could be multiple hosts, the VM will always go there. If there are no preferred owners available, then it's going to go to the second place choice, our possible owners, and then fail there. Now, if neither a preferred owner nor a possible owner are available, it's still going to move somewhere because it needs some type of node to own it, but it actually will not start up. So this gives you some ability to say, hey, if I have this high-end SQL database and the three servers that it can run on aren't there, don't actually start it up. So you can kind of get some granularity in how you want to manage your system through that.
Could you still start it up manually?
Yes, you can still start it up manually. You could also start it up with like a PowerShell script if you wanted to like have some type of delay or something like that. Question in the back. So the question is there a way to kind of visualize what are preferred owners, what are possible owners? Actually, in the new version, 2012, I don't know if it's in 2012, but in 2012 R2, we actually now add tabs to failover cluster manager that will actually list all the possible owners for a VM. There's no, I think if you're asking though, can I say what's a, if I look at node one, will it list all the possible VMs that could run on it? We don't have that way to view it. You could do that using something like PowerShell, where you could go and basically query the preferred owners for all of your VMs, filter that, display a list. So again, just to clarify my answer, you can look at a VM and figure out its preferred owners. You can't look at a host and figure out its preferred VMs, if that kind of makes sense. So starting VMs on preferred hosts. Now, this goes back to this kind of similar to this concept of the startup storm again. What we realized is, back with our traditional behavior, when we started to have a cluster fail, we saw a series of failures. The first thing that would happen was one host would crash. Those VMs would move to a different host. That host would get overloaded, crash, gradually fail. And so we kind of saw these VMs gradually shift to the last possible host, or you lost quorum, and then they wouldn't run anymore. Now, the way clusters traditionally worked is as soon as you have quorum, as soon as you have a majority of nodes in a cluster, all of those resources are going to try to start on those nodes. So let's say I have a 5-node cluster. Things gradually fail. As soon as 3 of those nodes come back online and I have majority, I'm going to try to start all of my VMs across those 3. Even though maybe I really need 5 to be able to run them. You know, we have that problem of the startup storm. It's not just running it in standard production, it's running it at these peaks. So what we did, we added this feature called persistent mode. And persistent mode is going to basically wait for the last host that the VM was running on to come online before actually starting it. And so what I mean by that is the last host that it's supposed to be running on. So I'll clarify that. So let's say I have my 5 nodes. I have 10 VMs, 10 VMs, 10 VMs, 10 VMs. They gradually fail. Well, what's going to happen once my first 3 nodes come back online? Only the 10 that were purposely placed on here will start here. The 10 that were placed on here, here, 10 here. And those last 20 VMs that were running on here, they're actually going to wait. Once this node comes up, those 10 VMs will go there. Once this node comes up, those 10 VMs will go there. So we're basically delaying the startup of the VMs, waiting for the host that you want them to run on to rejoin the cluster. So the obvious question is, okay, what happens if that node never comes back online? Well, we actually have a timer that's built in, 60 seconds, I believe. It could be 2 minutes. I think it's 60 seconds. And we'll basically wait 60 seconds for that host you want it to come on, to come back online. If that host still hasn't come back online after the 60 seconds, we'll then go back and start a few here, start a few here, start a few here. But this gives us the advantage as well of waiting for this startup storm to pass. We wait 60 seconds for the startup storm to pass, and only then will we add a few more VMs. So this kind of helps spread out the load as all of these VMs are trying to start up at the same time. And this is also configurable as well, that time delay. Now, in our old version, Windows Server 2008, this was actually a checkbox that you needed to enable. We actually hit it and turn it on by default in 2012. So we're going to automatically do this. If you want to disable it, you can do that through PowerShell or WMI. Now, keeping VMs off of the same host, kind of a different problem here. Why would you want to spread out your VMs across different hosts? Well, you may want to do this to make sure that you don't have a single point of failure. Let's say you have 2 virtualized domain controllers. You don't want both of those VMs running on a single host. You lose that host, you lose both domain controllers. You lose your infrastructure. So what you can do is assign a property to the VMs, and 2 VMs that have the same property will automatically try to spread themselves out. So in this example, if I have yellow for 4 of my VMs, those VMs are going to try to distribute themselves as optimally as possible. Now let's say another good example of when you want to use this is if you have a guest cluster. Remember, a cluster made up of, let's say, 4 virtual machines. There's SQL running inside the VMs. Well, we don't want them all on a single host, because if we lose that host, we lose our guest cluster as well. So with guest clustering, we're going to go and spread these out across our different hosts. Now, this is configured using PowerShell with a property called anti-affinity class name. It's pretty well documented on the cluster team blog. And recently, Virtual Machine Manager exposed this feature as well, and they call it availability groups. So if you go into Virtual Machine Manager and you say VM1 and VM2 are in the same availability group, those VMs are going to use this property and force themselves to spread out across different nodes. All right, well, that was an overview of some of the best practices that we have today, but there's a lot of cool things coming up. And first, I'm going to go over to our demo and show you how to actually go and configure a lot of these. So I'm going to log in here into my Windows Server 2012 preview box, R2 preview box here. And you can see that I have one of my virtual machines up and running already. So once I click on my virtual machine, you're going to notice that we actually built in some more information into what's happening in the virtual machine directly into Failover Cluster Manager. So we can actually have a look at the console, actually see what is running inside that VM, similar to what you get in Hyper-V Manager. You get information about the CPU, the memory, the heartbeat if it's enabled. Now, for this particular VM, I don't have an operating system installed, so not particularly exciting. But it kind of gives you an overview of what you're looking for here. Now, to answer the question in the back about CN node ownership, this is where we'll actually display on the per VM level what the possible nodes are. And you can go and adjust this by just clicking on this and changing what you want to be the preferred owners. So we can make these two our preferred owners. Now, when we go take a look at the resources of our virtual machine, this is where we kind of break down the VM into its different parts. Now, a VM on a cluster is going to have a disk, which many times is going to be put on your cluster shared volumes. And then you also have the VM itself, which contains the actual running virtual machine as well as the configuration file. And the configuration file is kind of a data file that gives some basic information like the name of the virtual machine, name of the virtual networks, GUIDs, things like that. If you go and change the properties of these virtual machines, this way you actually get some of the additional configuration settings. So here's some examples where you can automatically change how often you restart, whether you want to restart it on the same node, move it to a different node. Under advanced settings, you get your possible owners. Possible owners meaning your second place choices. Under settings, this is where we have access to our heartbeat settings. So we could go and configure it, and again, enabled by default on Windows Server 2012. Now, one other policy that I want to talk about here as well for availability is running resources in a separate resource monitor. This is a pretty not well-documented feature of clustering. And so to give you some kind of internals of what's happening here, by default, all resources that are of the same resource type, so all virtual machines, all file servers, they'll actually run inside a pool, which is the same process pool. Now, what this means is it has better performance. The other option that you can have is running each virtual machine inside an entirely separate process. Now, this means that you have slower performance. Now, kind of the trade-off of when you want to do one versus the other. The problem that you have with running too many things inside a single process is if one of those VMs crashes, it will, not always, but it very often will crash everything else that's running inside that same process. So if you have multiple, say, file servers or multiple virtual machines, you have a particular resource DLL that crashes, that can actually impact every other VM on that host. So what we tend to find people do as a best practice is keep everything in the same resource pool. Keep everything there initially. But if you notice that you have a particularly bad VM that always crashes or a particularly bad file server, isolate that. Retry it so that you kind of maximize that trade-off of performance versus isolation. Now back to the presentation. Now we're going to focus on what's new in Windows Server 2012 R2, specifically for clustering and Hyper-V. So first of all, big improvement around cluster scale. We increased the size of our clusters between 2008 and this release from 16 nodes to 64 nodes. four times the scale. We increased from 1,000 virtual machines in a cluster to 8,000 virtual machines in a cluster, eight times the scale. We increased the number of VMs on each host from 384 to 1,000, actually 1,024, so three times here. So we're continuing to make these clusters bigger, support more. And I also want to point out again that the free Hyper-V server also supports these same scale numbers. Now, going back to cluster validation, we mentioned that this was done slightly differently now that we have Hyper-V. So we built in a whole new set of Hyper-V tests. And basically, as we go and start cluster validation, if one or more of the nodes has the Hyper-V role enabled, we will go and run this additional set of tests. So it's going to go and check that you have the integration components installed on the hosts. It's going to check that you have memory compatibility between the different servers. So for example, you want to make sure that you're running the same type of processor, the same version level. Or if you have different version levels of Intel, you turn on processor compatibility. It's going to make sure that your actual virtual switches have identical names as they go across these different hosts. You don't want a virtual machine on node 1 that uses switch 1, then that VM fails over to node 2 that's on switch 2, because that VM still wants to use switch 1. So we're going to pre-test this, make sure that your virtual switches have the same name. We're going to make sure that the Hyper-V role is enabled across all of the nodes, that you have multiple networks. And we're going to do best practices for storage as well, give you recommendations, things such as use SMB, to really try to optimize the performance there. Now, we added node maintenance mode in Windows Server 2012. Node maintenance mode makes it easy for us to go and evacuate a host. So let's say you want to do patching. There's a problem, you need to go repair something, maybe it's a NIC, you have 100 VMs on that host. Well, traditionally, you would click on the first VM, live migrate, wait, do that again and again, or you'd have to run a script. Now, in Windows Server 2012, we now added the ability to do multiple select. So you can at least do multi-select and live migrate them all at the same time. We now have simultaneous live migration, so you can start to drain them all at once. But we still wanted to make this even simpler. And so you can now actually select a node, hit pause, and basically pausing a node means nothing else will come back to it. But you now see an option of pause and drain the roles. What this will do is it will actually lock the node so nothing can come to it, and it will start to live migrate all of the VMs off the host. So you can put a node into maintenance mode, go away for a couple of hours, come back, everything will be drained, everything will be evacuated. Then you can start doing your maintenance, and nothing will come back to it in the meantime. We then introduced cluster-aware updating, a way to patch all of our physical servers with zero downtime to our virtual machines. Now, the way that our cluster-aware updating works is it actually calls node maintenance mode. Cluster-aware updating says, you're the first node that I'm going to patch, go into maintenance. That, in turn, live migrates everything off of that node. The node's free. We then start our patching cycle. And with a patching cycle, we essentially find a baseline, which is a collection of patches. We go and figure out which of the nodes need which of the patches. And then one node at a time, we'll put it into maintenance mode, add the patch, make sure that the node reboots, make sure that the patch installation code says it's successful, make sure that the node can rejoin the cluster. We then take it out of maintenance mode, go to the next node, put it in maintenance mode, live migrate, and repeat throughout the cluster. Now, we've actually had some customers, actually just one customer, they have a 64-node cluster. They say that they are almost in a constant patching cycle. Once a week, they get new patches, just turn on cluster-aware updating, and just let things dynamically run. They don't need to worry about what's being patched, where it's being patched, where it's being moved. All of these best practices will stay in place, making sure that the VMs never have downtime while the whole physical infrastructure gets patched. We also wanted to protect against accidental shutdowns when we have multiple administrators using a single server. They may not know that there's VMs on it. They do something, they hit reboot, and then they kill all those VMs running on it. So we actually built awareness into the shutdown operation to make sure that you don't lose your VMs. When you click shutdown, the VMs will actually move to the best available node using live migration. So you click shutdown, it's going to wait, and it's going to say virtual machine service is running. Virtual machines are being migrated. And it's going to actually make sure that all of your VMs get off before the server shuts down. Now, you can disable this as well, and you can also add a timer. For example, wait 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, turn it off. Now, when this live migration happens, we're going to make sure that we use virtual machine prioritization so that we live migrate our high priority VMs first, then medium, then low. So even if we have a shutdown, hopefully our high priority ones are already off there. So cluster upgrading. A lot of people now say, hey, I'm really excited about this new version. What do I do to get there? So if you're moving from Windows Server 2012 to 2012 R2, you can live migrate between the different versions. Zero downtime to your virtual machines. However, if you're coming from an older version, Windows Server 2008, 2008 R2, to the new version, you go through the cluster migration wizard. It's actually been renamed the copy cluster roles wizard. And what this is basically going to do is look at your old resources, copy them over, start them up on the new VM. But there will be downtime. I'm actually going to go show you a demo of this now so you can kind of get a feel of how this looks. So here I have two clusters. I have a Windows Server 2012 and a Windows Server 2012 R2. So in the real world, for my virtual machines, I would just go live migrate. I'm just kind of showing you this cluster wizard if you have some older versions. So you can see right here I have an old virtual machine, an old file server, and an old DHCP server on my old cluster. Let's go over to my new cluster. Take a look at the roles. And right now we can see that there's just this single VM running on this cluster. So yep, here's our single VM. Yeah, move that down. Okay, so to actually go and perform this migration, we're going to say we want to copy our cluster roles. This launches the wizard. We now specify either the name of our old cluster or the name of one of the nodes. So we're going to say Simon P, Windows Server 12.2. Now what this is going to do is it's going to go and speak to that particular node, figure out what cluster it is part of, and then it's going to go and inventory everything which is currently running on the old cluster. And you can see that it has these three different roles. Now, as you go and expand it, you're going to see that we actually give some warnings ahead of time, or we give these green check marks. And you can go to view the report, a pre-migration report, to see what's going to work, what's not going to work, and what's going to require some manual steps. Not everything can be migrated. So as we kind of take a look here, with our filed server, it says this can be migrated, some manual steps are needed. This could be migrated, manual steps are needed. Clustered task scheduler can't be migrated. This VM can be. So it's going to give us some indication ahead of time of what we're going to need to do, changes in IP addresses, things like that. So let's go and select all of these. Now, next thing it's going to do is custom work for virtual machines. We'll actually give you the ability to remap your virtual networks as you do this migration. So you have your VM running on network one on the old cluster. As you go through this wizard, you can say you want the VMs running on network two. During the migration, we will actually update the configuration file and give you the new mapping so that your VMs will be able to come online as soon as possible. So I'm going to go ahead and change the mapping and say, this was the old switch. This is my new virtual switch. I then have the ability to go and either use new storage on my new cluster, or say I'm going to reuse my old storage. I'm going to take it off the old one, remask it to the new one. So in this case, I'll just say that I'm going to reuse my old storage. Now, one important thing to note here, we do not actually copy the data between the storage. So if you do use new storage, you have your old array, you have your new array. During the migration, you will have to do a manual file copy between. Use a robocopy, xcopy, whatever you want. So we've got our information. It's going to tell us what's going to be copied. We'll click next, and we'll see this migration takes place. Now, one important thing to note here as well is we do not do anything to your old cluster. We are cloning the roles, but we keep the old roles on the old cluster online. And we just keep them, we make the new ones on the new cluster offline. So this kind of gives you the ability to test a migration and feel safe because there's going to be no downtime to your production system. Once you kind of do the initial copy, you get another report, our post-migration report. And it's going to give you detailed steps as far as what you still need to migrate, what's actually changed. I go take a look at my new cluster, take a look at the roles, and we could see that everything has been migrated, but it's in an offline state. I take a look at my original cluster, I see everything is still online and running. So what I would then do to finish off the transition, I would offline the resource on my old cluster, remask the storage, bring it back online on my new cluster. I'm going to avoid these storage operations as part of the demo, though. So that is how we go and upgrade our clusters. So we also made some improvements to our cluster shared volume with this past release, releasing what we call cluster shared volumes version 2. And to give you some background, cluster shared volumes is our distributed access system. It's really optimized for Hyper-V because we kind of look at what type of traffic gets sent to Hyper-V virtual machines, and we design cluster shared volumes to be as fast as possible based on the different traffic types. We have different traffic types such as things that change the structure of the file system. We have traffic types that just do direct reads and writes to blocks of data. And so by categorizing that, it allows us to control whether one node can write at a time, if it's changing the structure of the file system, or whether multiple nodes can write simultaneously to different blocks of data, because they're not touching each other, so there's no risk of having any type of corruption. So with CSV version 2, we added new roles or new support. First of all, the scale-out file server that I talked about earlier, this file server that has the distributed access points, that runs on cluster shared volumes. Those files are now stored on a CSV disk. That's how we allow these multiple access points across our different nodes, pointing to a single disk. It also supports Hyper-V when running over SMB, so actually using a file share for your Hyper-V virtual machine. We improve support with backup performance, integration with third parties, so backup vendors, storage vendors, anyone else that sits in the file system. We have better integration with them. And then multiple subnet support for live migration. So you can live migrate virtual machines across different subnets, keeping them on the same CSV disk. But now we added, in this 2012 R2 release, what we call support for a shared VHDX file. So this is really going to be useful when you have a guest cluster. So as we kind of remember the architecture, we have our host cluster, which is our physical server, and that has 5 different options for the type of storage it can use. We then have our guest cluster that's made up of our VMs. And this now has the ability to add what we call a shared VHDX file. Now, the reason why we built this was speaking to a lot of hosters, or not necessarily hosters, but customers that have lots of individual users, they did not like exposing their actual file infrastructure to people that wanted a guest cluster. They just wanted to give that user 2 virtual machines, but not actually tell them, here's the name of your LAN, here's the name of your file share. They wanted to kind of hide that, abstract that. So what the shared VHDX does is it allows you to present the end user with a file, a VHDX file. That file could be stored anywhere, different arrays, different LANs, across storage spaces. And when you go and give your end users the ability to go build their guest clusters, all they need to do is actually point to a file rather than actually point to a LAN and access your storage fabric. Now back to some of the changes that you've probably already seen in the UI. Virtual machine prioritization. VM prioritization, kind of covered it a little bit. This is where we can rank our virtual machines, say what is important, what is not important. So you have 3 different rankings, and then the 4th, no auto start. So high, medium, low, do do not auto start. Now, we talked about no auto start earlier. That basically means when the VM crashes or a host crashes, that VM will not automatically start. We need something to manually start it. But high, medium, and low, what you want to do for these is use this to determine the start order. So let's say you have a shutdown. All of your VMs are offline. Well, we want to start high priority first, then medium, then low. This way you can get your infrastructure servers up first, line of business up second, and then other servers up last. Now, it's also it gives you some flexibility if you have a multi-tiered application. You know, you might have a back-end database tier that needs to come online first, a middle-level processing tier or business intelligent tier that comes on second, and then a front-end website that has to come online last. So by doing prioritization, you can also stagger the startup of these different application layers. Now, we also have a feature when you have prioritization enabled that allows you to shut down low priority VMs if higher priority VMs need resources. So let's say you have a large cluster, half the nodes fail. Well, all of those other VMs are going to move over to the remaining nodes, and we're going to make sure that all of the high priority ones come online, even if they then have to gracefully shut down a low priority VM. So this is going to allow you to rank them, make sure that your high priority are always running. Now, with our improvements around live migration, we added support for simultaneous or concurrent live migrations, unlimited number, live migration queuing. So if you do a group select in failover cluster manager of 100 VMs, but you can only do 10 at a time, the highest 10 priority will go, then next highest 10, then next highest 10, but it'll actually allow you to queue them up so you can, you know, leave, come back later. Live migration compression, a feature added in R2 that allows us to actually compress the memory data before copying it. Live migration over RDMA, remote direct memory access. This allows us to actually send our live migration traffic directly to the memory of the other server without having to have it be processed through that server's kernel. So even faster migrations, that's what I showed in the keynote this morning. And then also live migration with the best available node option. So if you clicked on the failover cluster manager interface and you say live migrate, you now see this option that says pick a node or move to the best node. So what exactly is that? Well, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, they've had a feature around for several releases known as intelligent placement. And intelligent placement allows people to basically rank what is most important when they go and move their VMs around. So based on, is it the host's free memory, free CPU, minimum amount of network traffic, or minimum amount of storage I/O? And so we kind of analyze this data that we've seen these customers send back to us about what they find to be most important when placing a virtual machine on the host. And by far, it was the most free memory. So what we said is, most of our administrators, when they move a VM, they want to move it to the host with the most free memory. Let's make it easy for you. What we now do within failover clustering is we are constantly tracking the amount of free memory on every single cluster node. And when you say, I want to live migrate to a node, we will automatically pick that node for you that has the most free memory. So you don't have to look at anything yourself. We do that filtering for you. When you do a node drain, or you do cluster patching, that's also going to use the same algorithm. It's going to automatically live migrate to the nodes with the most free memory to help balance that out, keep your ecosystem stable. Now, we've also added storage live migration, giving us the ability, giving us the ability to actually move the VHD between different SANs with no downtime to our virtual machines. Live migration over SMB. So you can now live migrate outside of clusters by going over SMB connection. You can live migrate from a cluster to a standalone host, cluster to cluster, standalone host to cluster, or even between two standalone hosts now. So a lot of times, you know, I say, hey, you can now live migrate between standalone hosts. People often ask me, well, why do I need a cluster if I have this mobility? Remember, clustering still protects you from unplanned downtime. You have a crash, we need that cluster logic to restart it, to move it to a different node. Live migration is used for planned downtime, when you know you're going to have downtime, because both of the nodes need to participate in the live migration. If one node is not available, it's crashed, you can't have a live migration. So failover clustering, still critical, still essential in the solution. So the question is, what about if you have different CPUs? It's not a problem. It's an architectural limitation in how the memory is built. So to kind of add some context here, what do you have to do if you have... So you still have a requirement to live migrate Intel to Intel, AMD to AMD. But you can live migrate between different versions of the processor. Now, to do that, what you actually do for the virtual machine, or sorry, for the host, is you enable processor compatibility mode. And what that means is it's going to allow these VMs to live migrate between these different versions, so up level, down level. Internally, the way that works is the highest version, so let's say I have version 1 and version 2. Version 2 is going to drop down to version 1, and they're going to live migrate at the version 1 level. So that's how that's handled internally. That's not so much a problem, that's just the way that the memory is actually built by a processor. So that's just something that we have to work around there. And then Hyper-V Replica, giving us the ability to go and copy our running virtual machines from one site to a different site. Now let's talk a little bit about Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica is basically a technology that lets us replicate any Hyper-V virtual machine. Whatever you want to run inside the virtual machine, you can do that. So you can replicate SQL, file servers, DHCP, whatever you want inside that VM, your custom application. Big limitation that you have with Hyper-V Replica is it does asynchronous replication, which means every 5 minutes, it copies the changeover. 5 minutes, copies the changeover. So if you have a crash after 4 minutes, you can potentially lose 4 minutes of data. So you need to be cautious with planning this. So it's not a real-time fault-tolerant system. It's an inbox solution for disaster recovery. Now, what we've done with our most recent release as well is change replication frequencies. So you can now replicate every 30 seconds, have only up to 30 seconds of data loss. Or if you're in an area where network bandwidth is expensive, you can replicate less frequently, every 15 minutes. So you're using up less network traffic. We've now added the ability to have chained replication. So you can replicate from the first site to a second site over to a third site as well. So you can have even higher availability and disaster recovery. And then we've added a new cloud service in Windows Azure called Windows Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager. This allows you to coordinate replication from our first site to our second site. So you can shut down an entire site, bring another entire site online using a single operation. But Hyper-V Replica is actually behaves slightly differently on a cluster. Question? So the question is, if you have a replication from site A that moves over to site B, how do clients get that? That ultimately depends on how you've set up your subnets and how you've set up DNS. So you can have a single subnet that spans across sites by using a VLAN. If you do that, when the VM moves, it's not going to change IP addresses. Most people, however, actually do have different IP addresses on different sites. So Hyper-V Recovery Manager will give you the option to actually change IP addresses as well. Now, naturally, what would happen if you don't get any of that configured is DNS will eventually solve the problem. After the VM moves from site A to site B, once the VM comes online, it creates a new record, loads it in that DNS server. DNS replicates over to the other site where your client's at. Every 20 minutes, the client gets a new DNS record. So at most, there would be a 20-minute delay based on that replication for that to happen for a client to be reconnected. There are some tips and tricks you can do to actually speed up the replication time, such as you can actually add multiple IP addresses to DNS records so that it will try IP address 1, then immediately IP address 2. That's a property called register all provider IP addresses. You can also change the frequency that the DNS replication happens. You can also change the frequency that a client actually downloads a DNS record. So they can try downloading it every 5 minutes, for example. So if a failover happens, at most it takes 5 minutes to get a new DNS record. Okay, so Hyper-V replica on a cluster here. And at this point, I'm going to not take any more questions. I am running a little short of time here, and I still have a lot to cover with Virtual Machine Manager. And a cool demo, too. So Hyper-V replica on a cluster, what is different? Well, we wanted to make our virtual machines so highly available on a cluster that we wanted to make our replication engine highly available as well. We figured if you're running a VM on a cluster, it's an important VM. If you're doing replication with a VM, it's an important VM. So let's make sure that we keep that replication cycle always running as well. So failover clustering now has a new role that you can deploy called the Hyper-V Replica Broker. And that's basically the replication service running on a cluster. If that node crashes, the replication service will actually fail over to another node and come online. And so this means as long as your cluster is online, your replication service will be highly available, and any VMs that are on that cluster will always be replicated. So it's kind of resiliency for the replication service as well. Now, the big change with this is that you cannot replicate within a cluster. There is only one replication engine per cluster. So you can't do a Hyper-V replica between node A and node B. You would just do a live migration to move them. So what this means is, as you actually go and configure multiple data centers or multiple sites, you go and build a cluster with a replica broker at site A, a cluster with a replica broker at site B, and you now have two separate clusters that are replicating between each other. Now, this changes traditional multi-site clustering, where we would have a single cluster spanning both sites. If you want to use the replica broker, you're now actually going to have an individual cluster at each of these sites. So let's actually go back to our demo and go and deploy one of these. So I kind of show you what it looks like here. So this is my Windows Server 2012 R2 preview. We're going to go configure a role. And here you can see that we have this built-in role, Hyper-V Replica Broker. We get to provide it with a name. Call it HVRB. Confirm the settings. And we now have this highly available replication engine that's running. Now from this, this is where we would go back and kind of configure replication as if it was on a standalone host. We go say replication settings, and this will go launch the same replication settings window that you get working on a standalone host. We want to enable replication, select the type of replication, allow replication from any server. But here's the important thing. Where are we going to go and store our virtual machines? We got to make sure we put them on our CSV disk. Remember, we're copying cluster to cluster. Let's put it on that CSV disk so that we can still use the highly available settings. So I can go to C, cluster storage, select a volume, click apply, and we've now configured replication for this server. And now if you actually wanted to go and configure replication for the VM, same as what you would do using regular Hyper-V Manager. Go down to Replication, enable Replication, go through the wizard, and go and configure what you're replicating it to. So finally, we're going to quickly run through what's new with System Center 2012 and our cluster integration points. So clustering is critical with Virtual Machine Manager. We realized that most customers that are using VMs are running them on a cluster. So we wanted to really try to build a lot of cluster logic directly into Virtual Machine Manager. You can now actually deploy clusters from bare metal. And what I mean by that is you can get brand new servers that don't even have an operating system, plug in redundant power supplies, redundant internet connections. We will boot to the baseboard management controller, which is kind of like the, the internal brain of the server before it gets an operating system, and go start a series of boots. Go download an operating system, go install it, go add the clustering feature, add the Hyper-V role, create a cluster, and join the additional service to a cluster. And so you can now do all of this end-to-end deployment from bare metal to creating a cluster using Virtual Machine Manager. We have support with the NVGRE Gateway. NVGRE Gateway is a new component that allows you to do isolated network virtualization. If you now have VMs that fail over on an isolated network, change their IP addresses, the gateway is going to be aware of that so that it routes traffic to the correct VMs after failover. You can now deploy and patch scale-out file servers using Virtual Machine Manager. This is new in R2. So as you think about building these different layers, we can now deploy our host clusters. We can deploy guest clusters using virtual machine templates. We can now deploy that server storage layer as well, our scale-out file servers. We have integration with the Hyper-V Recovery Manager. We can manage third-party clusters as well from VMware and Citrix. And we, of course, support SQL clustering for all our databases. Intelligent placement's a feature that I mentioned earlier that allows us to really design what we want to use our host for. Do we want to place our VMs on the host with the most free memory, storage I/O, disk I/O, or CPU? Easy to configure that, fully customizable, so you make sure that your VMs get placed where they should be. We have automated update management. This is pretty much the same thing as cluster-aware updating. It actually uses the same internal algorithm. But what's kind of the difference between VMM cluster updating and cluster-aware updating? I get asked this question a lot. When you do VMM's cluster updating, it can actually patch anything that VMM manages. This includes file servers, scale-out file servers, library servers, Pixie servers, WSUS servers, basically any type of infrastructure server that you can add inside Virtual Machine Manager, VMM can patch. The only exception there are vCenter servers, as VMware uses a different patching mechanism. So it gives you kind of more options of what you can patch. On the other hand, it only patches clusters that run Hyper-V, because that's all it manages. Cluster-aware updating, which is the one that's built into Windows Server, that will patch any type of cluster. So it will patch SQL clusters, file server clusters, as well as Hyper-V clusters. So what should you use? It depends how virtualized you are. If you are using Virtual Machine Manager, we generally recommend stay with that. It's got better integration with WSUS, and so probably going to be an easier end-to-end solution. And there's the repeated cycle there. We have dynamic optimization, which is built in load balancing across our Hyper-V hosts. So you can specify how distributed you want the VMs to be based on memory, so that we can kind of load balance them automatically. You have VMM server high availability. Actually, keep that Virtual Machine Manager server online. If it crashes, it restarts, failover to different nodes. And then you also have performance and resource optimization, which is integration between Operations Manager and Virtual Machine Manager. Now, this has been around for a while, but essentially, what we can do is configure alerts, such as too much host memory utilization. Operations Manager sends an alert to Virtual Machine Manager. Virtual Machine Manager will use its load balancing algorithm to distribute the VM, and it'll automatically balance traffic across these different infrastructures. So I often get asked, what's the difference between Pro versus dynamic optimization? They both do load balancing. So here's basically what you want to think about. Pro requires Operations Manager. If you don't want to use Operations Manager, just use dynamic optimization. But the benefit of Pro is it's much more customizable. Not only will it do alerts based on memory utilization, you can configure it to do alerts on other things, such as if there's too many VMs, if a network becomes unavailable. Basically, you can tie in any Operations Manager alert to go and then force VMM to do load balancing. So this is kind of the more advanced version, but does require the additional Operations Manager component. Now, beyond that, App Controller gives you the ability to go deploy VMs to your clusters. Configuration Manager lets you make your VMs and clusters secure and compliant. Data Protection Manager backs up your VMs, backs up your CSV disks, and backs up during live migration. Endpoint Protection backs up your supports your VMs and clusters by protecting them from malware and antivirus. Continuing through the System Center stack, Operations Manager monitors your clusters and VMs for different health alerts, different types of problems. There's management packs specifically for Hyper-V and for failover clustering. Orchestrator allows you to automate actions with clusters, such as deploying new clusters, adding new nodes. But you have to do it through Virtual Machine Manager. There's no direct connection to the failover cluster manager. It's all done via VMM. Service Manager allows end users to report problems with their VMs and their clusters. And System Center Advisor, free cloud service, will go and analyze your clusters and VMs for best practices. So as I wrap this up here, I hope that you see that we do have a lot of design considerations, a lot of best practices as we really think about getting this high availability throughout the data center. Now, I'm going to wrap this up here, but I do want to hear back from you as well. I'll stay here for up to 30 minutes, taking questions, helping you guys out with additional things. And if you have problems or things that you want to give us feedback to the engineering team, I'm more than happy to take that and pass that along as well. I mean, ultimately, our goal with clustering is to help you. We care about our customers with clustering more than anything because when you have a problem, that directly impacts our product. We want you to keep your services online, always highly available. We have a lot of free resources that are available online if you download these slides. The Microsoft Virtual Academy includes four courses on Hyper-V, failover clustering, and all the different system center components. www.microsoftvirtualacademy.com, and it's 100% free. And with that, I want to thank you all for attending, and I want to ask you if you could please complete an evaluation. It keeps us coming back, and it lets me come back to Copenhagen next year. Thank you, everybody.